Welcome to The Whole View. I'm Stacey Toth of RealEverything.com. I'm all about loving the skin you're in and being healthy inside and out.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I believe that scientific literacy is the key to improving public health.
Welcome back to episode 452 of The Whole View. I have a confession. When Sarah told me that she wanted to do this show topic, I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to.
You actually said, are you sure you want to open that can of worms?
Yeah.
Was the text. Oh, my God.
I think there were like three texts in a row. Like, are you sure? So here's the thing is sometimes we say things on the show that aren't popular or that I don't like. Yeah. And that is the thing about facts is facts are facts. Science is science. And how we feel about them or how we might have thought about them before might be different if we are open to hearing new information.
Well, and that's what this episode is. This is new information because the last time we sort of talked about this, the summary was, we don't have specific science on this, but here's related science, and we can kind of infer that it would also apply here. Now we have actual science showing that's not the case, and I think that's fascinating. Like, I'm really excited to do a little, like, woo, look at all the science from the last year that actually answers a question that didn't have a concrete answer before that we've all, been operating on, I think, an informed assumption, but, still an educated guess. And now we get to make choices based on evidence. And I think that's very exciting. I'm excited.
Yeah, that's how the text exchange went.
Yes.
You were like,
approximately.
You were like, but it's science and it's exciting and it's new.
I don't think you understand. While I was reading the papers, and I was like, my mind was so blown by the results that we're going to talk about today that I was nerding out actively while I was texting you.
Yeah, I don't think you quite understand the pot that you're about to stir, but let's get into it. And I also want to just remind people that science and information is nuanced. The information that we're going to share today, specifically on the topic of soaking and sprouting nuts, doesn't apply by logic to other things that we've talked about as soaking and sprouting. Mm-hmm. Of course, if information changes, we would share that with you. But I don't want you to hear this show that is specific and extrapolate it to other things. And I'm sure, Sarah, you'll get into the science of that.
For sure.
Bit.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For sure.
Let's jump in then.
So let me explain the origin of this podcast a little bit. Episode 413, we did a deep dive into the gut health benefits of nuts, because that is really exciting research showing basically that nuts and seeds have some really exciting vitamins, minerals, fiber types, and phytonutrients that our gut bacteria love. And there's certain nuts, especially pistachios and walnuts, and chestnuts and even almonds that are particularly well studied and shown to be beneficial for the gut microbiome. We had approximately a metric ton of follow-up questions. I'm going to read Vanessa's, but Vanessa's question is a representative example of questions about, what about the autoimmune protocol? But also what about soaking and sprouting nuts? So let's read Vanessa's question, and then we'll kind of get into all of this new science, because what I did was check to see if any research had been done since the last time I looked at this, and there was four new studies, which we'll also dive into. So Vanessa wrote, I'm interested in getting nuts and seeds back into my diet, but I'm wary due to my autoimmunity. I've read all the articles I can find on the subject on your website, even your dehydrator article, and ran a search, but there is no mention of soaking and dehydrating nuts and seeds to break down the enzyme inhibitors that cause digestive issues. Some nuts do give me stomach ache and bloating. I've experienced here and there with low FODMAP nuts, and have also purchased activated nuts that have already been soaked and dehydrated. I seem to get on fine with the activated nuts, but if you don't mention this process in all your articles, is this not something you advocate? Thanks, Vanessa. So I'm really excited to kind of get into this because the reason why there's no articles about soaking and sprouting nuts on my website is that there hasn't been science to definitively answer that question until recently. When I addressed this in The Paleo Approach, which I wrote in 2013, was published in 2014, I actually very specifically called out that there was no science confirming what we would expect, that soaking and sprouting nuts would reduce the phytates, which is the main problematic anti-nutrient in nuts. As we do have science that it shows that it decreases phytates as well as other problematic lectins like agglutinins in legumes and even grains. So we kind of go, well, like, oh, look, those are all seeds of some kind. We would expect it to be the same. But let me back up before we really dive into that part of the question and talk about sort of like health benefits of nuts, but why nuts aren't AIP, because I think that's part of Vanessa's question. She's following the autoimmune protocol and she's looking to reintroduce them. So nuts have been shown in a variety of studies that in moderation, so something like 20 grams, which is just shy of an ounce per day, can substantially reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, neurodegenerative disease, kidney disease, diabetes, infection risk, and mortality from respiratory disease. And they're big effects. So they're like 20 to 70% reductions. There's been studies showing that 3 1-ounce servings of nuts per week can reduce all-cause mortality, which is a general measurement of health and longevity, by 39%. So there's some big, big impacts of benefits of nuts. And this is probably through its gut health benefits. It's probably through its nutrient density. So nuts can be a really good source of especially minerals, but also some vitamins that we might not all be getting enough of otherwise. There's also, as I mentioned at the top, some really exciting phytonutrients. They're a really good source of the amino acid arginine, which is very important for gut health, particularly. And they tend to have a pretty healthy fat profile. So generally, nuts are richer in monounsaturated fats, and their omega-6 content is, I mean, that's why probably an ounce is sort of the maximum amount. Studies show that there's a huge benefit to about an ounce a day, but that those benefits don't continue with higher increase of nuts. So as a matter of fact, you start to see almost like a U-shaped curve with nut consumption, where 20 grams to 28 grams, which is an ounce, is probably the sweet spot per day. And getting much, much more than about 2 ounces a day, we start to get into not just no longer getting benefits, but maybe the omega-6 content of the nuts starts to drive inflammation more than all of the beneficial compounds in nuts can reduce inflammation. So if nuts are so great, the natural next sort of question is like, why aren't they considered AIP? And the reason actually is not purely due to phytates. So nuts are a very rich source of phytates, which are an anti-nutrient that binds with minerals, makes them hard to digest, that can also act as a digestive enzyme inhibitor. And we have a lot of science showing that we want to moderate phytate consumption. So if we were just going based on that argument, it would be a good argument for limiting nuts, but not eliminating nuts. The reason why they're eliminated initially on the AIP during the elimination phase of the autoimmune protocol is that the food sensitivity rate to nuts and seeds is extremely high, and that people with autoimmune disease seem to be even more likely to have a nut intolerance. So there have been studies showing that nut intolerance, which is separate from allergy, the allergy rate to tree nuts is about 1% of the total population. The intolerance rate, which means we're producing a different type of antibody, we're producing IgG antibodies against proteins in the nuts instead of IgE antibodies against proteins in the nuts. Studies have shown that that IgG-driven nut intolerance may affect anywhere between 20 and 50% of us. And definitely people with inflammatory conditions and autoimmune disease in general are more likely to fall under that umbrella. So there've been a variety of studies that have shown that people with autoimmune disease in general have more food intolerances than other people. So there was a 2018 study that showed that people with autoimmune disease, and it was a collection of about 8 different autoimmune diseases, that they produced basically about 10 times more IgG antibodies against foods than healthy people. And studies that have looked at specific conditions and looked at the rate of IgG food intolerances have shown that autoimmune disease seems to be a big risk factor. There seems to be something going on, and it probably is related to gut health, right? So we know that there seems to be an almost causal relationship that either gut dysbiosis or leaky gut are prerequisites for autoimmune disease to develop. And of course, those also are necessary in the development of these types of food intolerances. So we can kind of see maybe that there's a common cause. So it's not necessarily that the nut intolerance is driving autoimmune disease, but they're both related to the same gut health problems. So there's a 2015 study that was done in people with inflammatory bowel disease and basically showed that all of the nuts and seeds had a really substantial number of the patients have food intolerance. So for almonds, it's 16%. For pecans, it was 38%. For walnuts, 7%. Sunflower seed was 11%. And sesame seed was 7%. Compared to the healthy controls, where 0% of them had IgG antibodies against those nuts and seeds. And this has been shown also in people with unexplained gastrointestinal symptoms, which is very common in autoimmune disease, maybe a symptom of undiagnosed autoimmune disease. In that study, they had cashew was the highest signal. So those people had 50% of them had IgG antibodies against cashew. They also tested Brazil nut, which was 23%, almond 28%, and walnut, which was 3%. And similar, if you look at people with unexplained allergy symptoms, again, you see this really strong signal. Up to about 60% of those study participants had intolerances, right, IgG antibodies against nuts and seeds. And so this is the science that the recommendation to eliminate nuts and seeds initially in the autoimmune protocol comes from. There's always another way to go about it, which we've talked about on the show before, which is to do a food sensitivity panel and only eliminate the nuts and seeds that show up as positives. But it's really important to keep in mind that elimination and challenge is the gold standard for identifying food allergies and intolerances. And the tests even the top quality tests have about a 10% false positive rate and a 30% false negative rate. So it could mean that, especially with false negative, right, it shows that it's not an intolerance when it really is. Those are problematic on the autoimmune protocol. And it's why it's sort of simpler to eliminate them initially during the elimination phase, but because of their health benefits, nuts and seeds are phase one early reintroductions, because if they are tolerated, they are a really wonderful addition to the diet in terms of the nutrients and the health benefits that they can provide.
I think it's interesting too how that kind of response changes over time, not just like with stress on autoimmune, but also like my mom has developed this odd allergy to black walnuts as she's gotten older, whereas like it was one of her go-to nuts earlier, and not all walnuts, just black walnuts, you know? So I think the more we kind of pay attention to what's happening and how we feel, and even something like, I know for me, if I have something that doesn't agree with me, like my skin will start to tingle, like around my face in my mouth, like around the outside of my mouth. And that is like an early warning for me, I think, of, you know, pay attention. And it's subtle. But if I don't eliminate those things, then your body's response and the type of allergic reaction you have can also build up over time. It's not like, oh, let me just expose myself enough to this if you are allergic and like I'll get over it. That's not how that works, right?
No, I mean, I will totally second that mouth tingling is a symptom that should be paid attention to during reintroductions. So I tried peanuts once because I just wanted to know. I'd eaten peanut butter a lot. I wasn't looking to incorporate them on a regular basis, but I wanted to know if they would be okay as a sometimes food. And the way my mouth tingled was so alarming that I was like, oh, like I feel like this is a histamine driven reaction and I maybe have a peanut allergy and I have never tested them again. And I think that is a really important signal to pay attention to, actually, is sort of mouth and lip tingling, because that is sort of a pre-anaphylactic type histamine symptom.
Good to know. Okay. So now we've kind of established that piece of it. And we know that nuts are good for us. The ones that I enjoy eating, I very much mm-hmm. enjoy eating. And so I guess the question is, you know, what's the best format then for once you are like, okay, this works for me, I'm going to go forward. Or maybe you're feeling that tingle and you're like, oh, what if I soaked and sprouted this? Will that make it better? Put that right on a platter for you.
It was like a professional segue. It was excellent.
That's embarrassing. Almost as bad as your puns.
I mean, come on. My puns are on a pedestal. All right. So let's talk about why we would have thought that soaking and sprouting nuts would have been good. So there's actually a lot of evidence, especially in legumes, but also in grains, that soaking, sprouting, and fermenting reduces agglutinins and phytates. And it's a big level of effect. So it depends on the temperature, the soaking time, exactly which legume you're talking about. So there's not a rule of thumb that like 12 hours is 50% and 24 hours is 90%. That doesn't exist. But there are a variety of studies that have compared different legumes, have compared different soaking versus fermenting treatments. And what they all show is really substantial amounts. So for example, soaking pigeon peas for 6 to 18 hours reduces agglutinins by between 38% at 6 hours and 50% at 18 hours. Soaking kidney beans for 12 hours reduces agglutinins by almost 50%. There was a study that looked at white beans, broad beans, lentils, chickpeas, and soybeans and showed that soaking for 12 hours, this one was very specifically at 78 degrees Fahrenheit, reduced phytates by between 8 and 20%. But another study showed that fermentation, which is a slightly longer procedure in legumes, reduced phytates in kidney beans by 85%, in soybeans by 77%, and in mung beans by 69%. So all of those different treatments, right, they're all, right, the difference between soaking and sprouting is time and, you know, the amount of time in water versus the amount of time then in air in a sprouting jar. A longer soak will turn into a fermentation. It doesn't necessarily need to have a culture added because it will ferment based on the natural cultures in the air and on the legume. So a fermentation is basically a longer, warmer soaking, and a sprouting is a shorter soaking that is followed by sitting, you know, moist in a sprouting jar. So all of those things are variations of the same treatments, and it's a pretty high magnitude of effect. It's different for different legumes and different for different types of anti-nutrients that we're looking at, but they're all pretty impressive effects, right? So, you know, we're basically seeing modal 50% type effects for a reasonable procedure that most of us would, you know, not find super inconvenient to do in our homes. And so it's been assumed in sort of alternative health communities broadly that nuts would be similar, even though there hasn't been scientific evidence to even look at this until last year. And actually, when I wrote the Paleo Approach, I'm actually going to quote what I wrote. I said, it is commonly postulated that soaking nuts in salted water and then drying them improves digestibility, reduces enzyme inhibitor activity, and decreases phytates. This has not been documented in the scientific literature, but anecdotal accounts suggest that many people could tolerate nuts that have been soaked and dried, even if they do not tolerate raw or roasted nuts. And that, again, you know, the reason why I've never written an article about this procedure is because there was no scientific evidence. We're all basically have been operating on this educated guess. If it's the same for legumes and for grains, surely nuts and seeds would be similar enough. But these four new studies have really shown that that's not the case. So let's start with the most rigorous study that had the most different kinds of nuts and different types of soaking conditions. This was just published in July. And what they basically, you know, their whole goal was to test whether activating nuts, which is soaking either with or without salt, and then low temperature drying is what an activated nut is. So what they did was they had almonds, walnuts, and hazelnuts, and then they measured the mineral content of the nuts and the phytate content of the nuts after a variety of different soaking conditions, 4 hours or 12 hours with or without salt. And they also did whole nuts versus chopped nuts. And what they showed was that the phytate concentration differences in all of those different soaking conditions were quite small, and they ranged from a 12% decrease to a 10% increase in phytates, which is why I texted you with so much excitement, because even though it's not exciting to think that this hypothesis we've all been operating under is actually false, scientifically, that's a really interesting thing that soaking would actually increase the phytates. So for example, almonds started with 531 milligrams per 100 grams of phytates. And after soaking for 12 hours with salt, phytates went up to 562 milligrams per 100 grams. If you only did a 4 hour soak, the phytates was even more. It was up to 582 milligrams per 100 grams. And it didn't matter. It still went up even if you didn't have salt. So 12 hours with no salt, it still went up to 578 milligrams per 100 grams, which just to me is a fascinating biological process. It was very similar for other nuts, especially hazelnuts. Walnuts did decrease phytates, but it was about a 5% decrease. So they started at 523 milligrams per 100 grams, and sort of the best situation was 12 hours with salt. It went down to 501 milligrams per 100 grams. And then the other piece of this was that overall, soaking tended to leach out minerals from the nuts as well. So they ended up with not a very big difference and potentially a small increase in phytates, but also a small decrease in the minerals. So what the study actually showed was that the ratio of phytates to minerals didn't change. And that really shows that activating nuts did not improve nutrient bioavailability or reduce phytates, which, you know, potentially can act as a gut irritant. So calcium went down in almonds, iron went down in almonds, and zinc. Basically, it went up a teeny tiny bit. It went from 2.94 milligrams per 100 grams. In the best condition, it went up to 2.99 milligrams per 100 grams. Walnuts, which had the decrease in phytates, had the biggest loss of minerals. So they had calcium went from 88 milligrams per 100 grams down to 77. Iron went from 2.72 down to 2.52. Zinc went from 2.93 down to 2.72. And then the other thing that was really interesting about this paper was there was no pattern. So certainly they showed that the mineral loss was greatest with chopped nuts, which makes sense to me, right? The surface area against the water is higher. But there wasn't like a particular condition had the best results in terms of minimizing phytates, and a particular condition had the best results in terms of preserving minerals. It was kind of all over the place. So there wasn't a, you couldn't say out of this paper, well, look, the differences are small, but if you always do 12 hours with salt, that's the best, you know, that's the best way to maximize the benefits of soaking. You can't, there's no conclusion like that to draw from this data because there were no patterns in terms of which soaking condition and which nut had which effect, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. What comes to my mind is what not to do with assumptions or why not to make assumptions. And I think, you know, what we do know about nuts is, you know, the nutrient value that they have, but also that, you know, it is possible for them to go rancid, that they're a fresh food. And so I'm wondering, completely throwing you a ball from left field, if there's anything in the scientific literature about the idea of how long to keep nuts, should they be refrigerated? Like, does any of this stuff come into play either while we're talking about all of this? And then also, second question, what would happen if, for example, you're using cashews for what a lot of us use cashews for in paleo type grain-free baked foods, right? Or dairy-free icings or whatever, right? Like you're soaking the cashews in order mm-hmm. to get them soft to make them pliable. Like is there information and recommendations on those personal and the information that personally affects me?
I totally have that information prepared. So no worries on that. No, in terms of rancidity, right, that's a very different process than what these studies are looking at. So, you know, we do have to think about the shelf life of nuts. Long-term storage, it is definitely better to keep them in the freezer and rather than in the cabinet. So like that is a whole different, that is oxidation of fats. And that comes from, right, nuts that have a higher polyunsaturated fat content, like almonds, can go rancid faster than nuts that have a higher monounsaturated fat content, like cashews. So it's a little bit different from different nuts. But like the general recommendation is no more than 6 months in the pantry. And I personally have moved to, you know, thinking about buying smaller packages of nuts that I don't go through very quickly so that they're more like being used in 2 to 3 months if they're going to be in my pantry, otherwise moving them to the freezer for longer term storage. And then I typically, out of the freezer, I would typically roast them to get that crisp back. But that is a very different biological process than what's happening here with phytates and mineral concentration. So I do definitely want to get to, though, like, what if the recipe requires, like, soaking cashews? Because I also like making homemade cashew cream cheese. And so let's talk a little bit about, we're going to get there, but let's talk a little bit about the gut gastrointestinal symptoms with nuts. So I think it helps to first say, there was a 2019 paper that looked specifically at activating almonds and showed also about a 5% or less than 5% decrease in phytates in that particular study. So there is some confirmation there in terms of, you know, really not having a huge effect on the phytate. That was not as rigorous a study, but we definitely will still put a link in the show notes for everyone who's interested in going back to the original studies that I'm talking about. There was a slightly older study that actually looked at 2018. I mean, it's super old. It's a couple years old now. It was December 2018, so it's only 2 years old. But this study actually looked at how activating nuts could impact gastrointestinal symptoms. So what they did was a blinded design. So participants didn't know if they were getting the activated nuts or the regular nuts. And it was a crossover trial. So they spent 4 weeks in one group and then 4 weeks in the other group. And they had four different preparations of almonds each for 12 days. So they had whole unsoaked, whole soaked, sliced unsoaked, and sliced soaked. So again, we're sort of looking at how soaking may impact the phytates differently and the minerals differently when under basically a chopped nut condition where you've got more surface area contacting the water during the soaking. And what they did was they actually looked at gastrointestinal symptom differences between all of those different conditions. And what they showed was that soaking under a blinded condition did not actually improve the gastrointestinal tolerance. There was no difference in any of the measures that they looked at between all of the different nut conditions. So, I mean, I think what this tells us is that when we find an activated nut that works for us, there's a couple of possibilities. One is it could be the type of nut. Activated nuts tend to be organic. They tend to be fresher. So it could be a rancidity issue. There are certainly plenty of examples of people in the autoimmune community who have like vegetable oils, right, oxidized fats as a symptom trigger. So it could be the nut quality. It could also be the nut type. So maybe it's easier to get activated walnuts and you're comparing that to consuming raw almonds. And it could also be the often activated nuts are dehydrated. Sometimes they're roasted. So sometimes you get sprouted nuts that are roasted as well. And generally, cooking of any food does improve digestibility. So there's been a variety of studies basically showing that cooking all different kinds of foods basically makes it more easy to digest, and we can basically get more of the nutrients out of it with our digestive system. So there's some other possibilities. And then the last possibility that I think is worth mentioning is the placebo effect. And I want to be really clear that the placebo effect is a real effect. It is not the same as saying it's in your head. I used air quotes there. It is an actual legit effect that when you think something is going to be beneficial for you, biologically it actually is. So it is not that it's in your head that you don't have gastrointestinal symptoms. It's that there's something about the expectation that actually creates a biological difference. And it may be mediated through something like the stress axis, or it might be much more complicated than that. But that is another possibility as well.
I'm wondering too if, for me, for example, I know like when I'm on vacation, I digest foods that I would normally have a more difficult time with at home more easily because there's less stress, right? And so if you tell yourself, I mean, I'm just kind of explaining an example, just one example of placebo would be if you tell yourself, this is not going to bother me because it's soaked and sprouted, then therefore your body could be less stressed and more able to digest it, for example. Yep. Right? Okay.
100%.
Making sure I'm understanding the process. And I do think that there's a lot of things like that, especially in the community. And we haven't really talked a lot about it, but I think that's, you know, part of the whole orthorexia discussion around these types of getting very finite into a short list of foods that you tell yourself you can or can't eat. And it's why we have a science-based approach to the autoimmune protocol and then ask you to reintroduce these foods in a monitored way to see how you feel. Because ideally, we're at a place where food does not stress us out. Like, food is just the thing that is nourishing us and giving us energy and helping us feel good, and is not something that is stressful. And so I think that's worth noting, because if you've been eating your nuts soaked and sprouted and you're all stressed out now, like, let that go. Take in a deep breath and then exhale all that stress, because it doesn't matter. It's in the past and there's absolutely nothing that you can do about that. And so if you want to try without, or you want to try maybe just dehydrated, I like that idea, right? If I'm hearing you correctly, that, you know, taking high quality raw nuts and dehydrating them might improve your digestibility without increasing phytonutrients. Both two thumbs up there, right? but what are some other kind of things? Like, we talked about making these alternative foods. Like, I'm kind of wondering, implementation wise, what does this look like?
So I think it's important to remember that what the research really is showing is not to bother soaking, right? But the differences in phytates and minerals is small. We're talking about most of these studies showing about a 5% difference in most conditions, up to about a 10% difference. So if a recipe requires soaking for making, you know, cashew yogurt, cashew cream cheese is one of my family's favorite things. You know, there's not a good argument against soaking, except for this paper that was published just a couple of months ago, which tells us that the soaking step is best performed probably in the refrigerator. So what this study actually did was look at the process of activating almonds. And they used, again, a sort of a bunch of different, they looked at blogs and videos for the most common methodology that's recommended, and then tested a variety of those, like, more common methodologies for, like, a sort of replicating, like, a homemade activation protocol for nuts. And then what they actually did was look at how that environment was in terms of how conducive it was for foodborne pathogens. So basically giving yourself food poisoning by activating nuts. So they, you know, they do that type of study by inoculating with, you know, like, enterohemorrhagic E. coli, right, Listeria, Salmonella, like, the bad things that are the subject of food recalls. But what they're doing basically is they're testing the situation of, let's say there was a small amount contaminating your nuts, and then you activate them at home. How does that foodborne pathogen grow in those conditions? And what they basically showed was that the warmer your room temperature, so they looked at 15, 18, and 23 degrees Celsius. The 18 is about 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And they looked at then a lower temperature, sort of dehydration, 66 degrees Celsius was their dehydration temperature afterwards, and they looked at how that impacted the growth of their pathogens, and basically saw that the warmer it was and the longer the soak, the higher the pathogens. And they showed that you know, this is definitely a situation where you know, if there was a small amount of a pathogen on the nuts, like an amount that wouldn't make you sick if you just ate the nuts out of the bag, but then you did this soaking and sprouting soaking and dehydrating step with your nuts, that you're creating an environment where that pathogen will replicate itself and then be enough to potentially make you very, very sick. So what they showed was that the best condition was like a shorter time period and cooler than about 15 degrees Celsius, which is pretty, it's not too many people walking around with indoor temperatures below 15. My interpretation of this is when we're soaking for a recipe, there's no reason why we can't soak in the fridge. If we've let go of the idea that soaking is going to reduce phytates and improve the bioavailability of minerals, which these studies definitely show is not the case, then we can go ahead and soak our cashews in the fridge for however long it is to get them soft enough for whatever recipe it is that we're doing, and go from there. So I think there isn't compelling reason to avoid activated nuts, except for maybe the almonds. Almonds had like the biggest difference, but definitely that it's not a good use of our time or resources to do this step.
And I just want to kind of like, if I was going to recap everything in a little nutshell, you're welcome.
So good.
Like it's uncomfortable for me, but I know how much you love it. My takeaway is I'm buying small packages of nuts and I'm storing them in the fridge or freezer if I'm not consuming them quickly. Those nuts are ideally raw organic. I could dehydrate them myself if I want to make them more easily digested. And then if I'm going to be cooking with them and need them softened, that soaking process would be in cool water. Don't start with hot water. And then it would be in the fridge. Just recapping for everybody.
That's an excellent recap.
Okay. The last question that I have for you is then about nut milks. So mm-hmm. We have both store-bought and homemade that you can make yourself in a blender, which does sometimes heat up, depending on what blender you're using and how old the little engine is and all that, right? Like sometimes you touch your old blender and you're like, ooh, that was close. Mm-hmm. And then also on machines like, gosh, isn't there something called like Almond Cow? You know what I mean? Like where there are machines where you put in your nuts and you put in water and then out comes your own nut milk at home that doesn't have like all the additives and stuff in it. So is any of this extrapolated to those?
So
please don't take my almond milk away.
Oh, I'm not going to. So when we're talking about a commercial product, those have testing procedures as part of, you know, they have to do safety testing. They have to show that they're not going to give you food poisoning. So I don't know, you know, for every different nut milk that's out there, what the temperature is of their conditions. But it is something that, so it turns out that companies aren't allowed to kill you with E. coli. So that's what food recalls are for. Right. I know. So that's yay. So in terms of commercial nut products, you know, you're not going to get food poisoning. If you do, report it, because that means a recall is and probably a factory inspection is required. In terms of making at home, like just because something warms up for a little while doesn't mean it's like automatically going to be full of bacteria. So think about general like food safe guidelines, right? Body temperature for about 2 hours is the sweet spot. Like if you had something with mayonnaise in it, right? Raw egg, that can be a source of salmonella. 2 hours on the counter is where you then throw it out. So those types of same rules, right? 5 days in the fridge, all of those different rules come from studies of what conditions are conducive to growing growing pathogens. And so, you know, general, if anyone's, I used to work in a commercial kitchen, I had to do my food safe certification in order to do that. That's the Canadian version. I don't know if that's what the American version is called. But that's where, you know, a quick Google search, USDA has lots of different, you know, all of those different rules are listed on the site of how long at room temperature versus how long warm before you are best to throw something out. So just think about those types of guidelines when making homemade nut milks. So if it warms up for a little bit, no big, put it back in the fridge. It'll cool down. It'll be awesome.
I just want to thank you for not taking anything away from us today. But educating.
I just freed up everyone's time is what I actually did.
Right. Educating and informing us, giving us time back. These are all good things. Maybe it's not quite the pot I was worried you were stirring.
For me, I think the most interesting part about this is to try to figure out why. Why would nuts, and to be fair, none of these studies have looked at seeds. So I don't know where sunflower seeds would fall on the spectrum, if they would act more like legumes in sprouting or if they'd act more like nuts in sprouting. But what I, one of the things that I did to try to wrap my head around, like, why would nuts be different, was actually sort of look at the botanical difference in terms of what we're eating versus what is actually the whole seed. So when we consume a legume, legumes grow in a pod that typically have multiple seeds. If you just had that green bean plant in your garden and you didn't harvest the green beans on time, the bean would harden and then it would split open and the seeds inside would fall and then they would be in the dirt and they would eventually sprout with that environment. When you wanted to plant a nut, if you wanted to grow your own walnut tree, by the way, walnut trees are a production. I read about it on WikiHow and decided never to plant my own walnut tree because it's like so much work. So nuts are different. So the nuts typically have, right, there's the part that we eat in the middle. That's the, we think of as the nut. Then there's the hard outer shell. And then there's a husk typically around that hard outer shell. And the way that you would get a nut to sprout is you would soak, like for growing a walnut, you would soak that nut. You would keep it in a moist, warm environment for like 6 months. And then the nut on the inside starts to sprout and the sprout pushes the shell open to split. So it actually sprouts before the shell opens. And we'll put links into how to plant a walnut tree from WikiHow, because it's epic. It involves a cement mixer. It's like so much, or a step where you can run over them with your car. It's so much. This is not on my bucket list in any way. But basically when we look at nuts or even like not true nuts, right? Droops, that are basically a nut with a more pulpy fruit around it, which a lot of what we classify as tree nuts are actually droops. They grow differently than a legume does, right? A legume, the pod splits open and then the seeds are everything that plant needs to grow itself. Whereas a nut, if you took off that hard outer shell and you tried to get just the almond on the inside to sprout and grow, it's never going to happen. It needs to be protected in that shell. So it's not a full explanation as to why things are different, but to me, it sort of thinks about it kind of answers that part of the question of when we're soaking nuts, it's not actually the whole seed. The whole seed includes that hard outer shell. Whereas when we're soaking legumes, it is the whole seed. And to me, that's likely part of why they behave differently under those similar soaking conditions.
I mean, I'm not surprised that leaving something wet for 6 months might be a problem. Like, I'm thinking of mold, and like mold, you don't want that. No.
But that is, I am telling you, that is how to make a baby walnut tree out of a walnut.
I'm gonna hard pass and you know, move on.
It's so much.
Okay, I do want to give a shout out to our original nut sponsors, not the show, but just because we love them and they're a Georgia local for you. Georgia Grinders, one of the reasons that we are like, I'm recognizing that they're great is because they're slow roasted, right? Their nuts are not sprouted. They're slow roasted, which would make them more digestible.
More digestible.
And not increase phytonutrients. So shout out to our original nut sponsors, George Grinders. We're still giving a 2 thumbs up on these guys. And I can tell you, they are delicious. So if you're looking for some,
I just ordered maybe a large plural number of jars of pecan butter. I was like, I'm just going to get the case and away we go.
Yeah. So if you're wondering to yourself right now, where do I go? Perhaps it's to GeorgiaGrinders.com, completely unsponsored, unprompted, just me saying this stuff is delicious and would fit all the check marks in the boxes that we've defined here today. Sarah, I am excited to hear what you really think about this topic over on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And what our little like side conversation was before we had the show. We'll be sharing all the details as well as whatever else comes top of mind. We always share information and the behind the scenes and a little glimpse into our life over on our Patreon show, which you can pop over to. Just search Patreon, The Whole View, and it also gives you exclusive access to ask us questions that we answer in a timely manner. Sometimes here on the show, you get bumped up on the list. So make sure that if you love the show, that not only are you leaving a review for us, thank you so much, but you're also becoming part of our Patreon fam. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful, wonderful, nutty day.
We'll be back next week. Do you love The Whole View podcast? We'd love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen and share a podcast with your friends and family.
And did you know that you can now get exclusive behind-the-scenes content on Patreon for less than the price of an almond milk matcha a month? Your Patreon membership supports us and gets you access to a monthly bonus episode.
But not for kids' ears, because our bonus content is explicit. You can find us as The Whole View on Patreon for our real, unfiltered thoughts on this week's episode. A nutty day. Love it.
Oh my God. You're welcome. I gave you two puns this episode.
I'm so excited because I brought all the puns last week.
So. I know. I was like trying to grab sound clips and I realized that there were like ones that you said to me that I missed. Like I was just like focused on the notes and there was at one point you were like, shall we dive in? And I was like, yeah, okay. Oh, man.